its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are into February. Later on this hour on Current State, we learn about the role of creativity for people incarcerated in Michigan, an intriguing project known as the Prison Creative Arts Project, PCAP. We'll talk with one of Michigan State's longest-serving employees. Ron Flynn is calling it a career here in 2014, and he's seen an awful lot of changes here in East Lansing over his tenure, and I look forward to our chat an awful lot. That and more coming up here this hour on Current State. Thousands of Michigan households and businesses that use propane gas continue to be squeezed by a shortage of the fuel. The scarcity stems in part from a large and unusually wet fall harvest. Farmers who had to dry crops before storage used more of the fuel than usual and lowered reserves. And that shortage has been worsened by our unusually cold winter. The situation has led to dramatic fluctuations in propane gas prices, along with concerns about price gouging and customers going without heat. Now, last Friday, we sent Current State's Kevin Lavery to DeWitt to talk with propane customer John Kelly about how the situation's playing out for him.
So how many square feet is your home? Does it require a lot of propane to heat?
No, it doesn't. We're small. It's a 960-square-foot home. Full basement, but we don't live in the basement. Propane tank's right over there. We use probably 800 to 1,000 gallons a year, and that's for heat and hot water, clothes dryer. I'm opening the lid on the tank, and we see we've got just over 45%, 46%.
And this was refilled as recently as?
2 days ago. And it wasn't filled. I got 150 gallons. So.
And when do you anticipate having to get another shipment out here?
I talked to the guy that delivered. He had no idea. He said, call them when I get down to 20%. So I'm trusting them.
But no guarantee once that happens that there'll be a truck or some propane.
Well, this company's been great. I'm happy with them, but you're right. No guarantee. Now, this is one tank that I have for my home. I have another tank behind this building for my business. And that's the one that I'm not able to get propane for flat out right now. I don't need it, but if I did, I'd be in a heap of trouble.
Propane customer John Kelly of DeWitt there, along with Current State's Kevin Lavery. Now, to update this story and to take a look ahead, we're joined by Judy Powell now, spokeswoman for the Michigan Public Service Commission. Welcome, Judy.
Hello.
Can you put the shortage in some kind of context here for us? How much lower are reserves compared to normal, let's say?
Reserves in the region are down 46% compared to last year at this time. So it's a significant decrease in supply.
And how is that playing out exactly? I mean, we just heard John Kelly's situation. He's got less in his tank than he probably does ordinarily. Is it playing out that way for most folks?
The shortage is a statewide problem. It is more pronounced in the Upper Peninsula, especially the Western Upper Peninsula. With regard to customers in the Lower Peninsula, we are told that most dealers do have an adequate supply. So that is a good news, and they're expected to keep supply to help customers avoid running out at this point.
Now, I alluded to some demand pressures a few minutes ago. Apparently, last fall, the harvest was unusually wet and more propane was consumed than normal just to dry out those crops before
right.
they could
Michigan,
be stored.
Michigan farmers don't use propane to do that. Very few in Michigan do that. However, other states rely heavily on it. And this is a regional problem. There are 35 states that have propane emergencies in place right now. So even if our farmers are not the heavy users of propane like other states are, we're all affected by that. But that kicked off the difficulty back in the fall, followed immediately by bitter cold temperatures. You recall the polar vortex hit. Followed by heavy snowfall. And this is a fuel that's transported via truck And so now they have to deal with additional challenges to get the supply where it's needed. So that it is a regional problem, and we're one of 35 states that have declared emergencies.
Here in Michigan, Judy, is it more of a demand problem or more of a supply problem?
It's a supply problem. There is a shortage. And so we did, at the Public Service Commission, put out a news release a few weeks ago indicating that tight supplies are out there, and that a couple weeks ago that tight supply was expected to be even tighter, as a facility in the Upper Peninsula was not going to be receiving product to make propane. And so they actually did run out in Rapid River, Michigan, at this facility a couple weeks ago. The reason was that a facility in Wisconsin was installing new pumps, and so the pipeline that supplies them was not moving product that they need to make propane. So those pumps were installed, and the good news is those new pumps are moving more product, and they actually, a week ago, started making propane available to customers again in the Upper Peninsula, a full day ahead of schedule. So that was a little bright spot. But they are operating at full speed. However, they're still sending trucks to Alto, Michigan, which is near Grand Rapids, as well as Superior, Wisconsin. Truckers are going as far as Texas to get supply. And as you can imagine, that adds to the time it takes to get back. There are some other difficulties when trucks go through multi-states like that. They each have their own weight restriction. So some of them were going to Texas, but maybe only being able to get filled maybe two-thirds, because the states in between Michigan and Texas had more stringent weight restrictions in place. So the governor has announced that he is directing the Michigan Department of Transportation to work with the federal government on this and attempt to get a waiver in place to allow trucks to be fully loaded when they come back to Michigan.
They have to go all the way to Texas, though.
Yes.
That is why is Texas so special? Why
they are a major hub. The other location is in Kansas, and Kansas's price was significantly higher than the Texas price. So that is why they are going long, long distances to get supply. And we're not the only state that's sending trucks that far. It is many of the 35 states with the emergency are also sending trucks that far.
There are a lot of links in this chain, obviously. Last week, the state police told MERS News that they had no reports of people losing their heat to homes because of the propane shortage. Has that changed since then? Are you aware?
As of Friday, where there was another meeting, the state police still had not heard from any actual residential customers who ran out.
Okay. Overall, do you expect this situation to get worse before it gets better?
We expect supplies to remain tight. There are some bright spots, however, but we are still cautious. The plant in the Upper Peninsula is working. The supplies in West Texas are being diverted to the Midwest because they know it's needed here. The New England states that were heavily affected by this problem actually started receiving imports from Europe. So they are in better shape, which means there's less pressure on the Midwest. So that's a good thing. Pipeline operators are prioritizing propane batches on pipelines. So that's getting moved more frequently. And then, the Lower Peninsula dealers have told us that they expect supplies to be available. So that is the good news. But there's still a lot of price volatility in the market. The facility I mentioned in Kansas was, the wholesale price was as high as $5 a couple weeks ago. So that has significantly dropped to the $2.42 range.
Are you concerned about price gouging? I mean,
we have had reports of from customers who consider prices to be way out of line. And so the Attorney General does have a division that takes complaints on that. And they have a toll-free number that folks can call at 877-765-8388. And they will investigate any complaints.
I spoke over the weekend and on Friday with Joe Ross of the Michigan Propane Gas Association, who represents the retailers who sell propane gas. And when I asked him about price gouging, he claimed that the propane sector is extremely competitive. But he says, and this gets a little wonky here, but he says there's always a roll of the dice by suppliers before the heating season when they determine how much they'll need. And if too many buy too little, then they're forced to buy on the open market or spot market, I believe, which is a lot more expensive. And that is in play here with these price fluctuations.
Yes, we've heard the same thing. If a dealer is wise, they take care of things beforehand. There are other people who like to play it a little more risky and buy on the spot market, and they are probably the ones who are having the difficulties.
Missouri Senator Mike Parson said the propane industry should have been better prepared for this. Does he have a point there? Is he right?
Well, that is something that I'm sure they are reviewing. You know, Michigan does not regulate propane. The Public Service Commission does not regulate, but we do monitor the propane markets, the energy markets, to make sure Michigan has supply, regardless of the kind of energy. So it was our staff who, back in December, first alerted Governor Snyder's office about the situation, and so he, at that time, did issue an executive order declaring a propane emergency, and since then has issued two more. As recently as Friday, a third was issued. So that allows for hours of service waivers to be in place, meaning that truck drivers can drive longer than they normally can.
Okay. We're talking with Judy Powell now of the Michigan Public Service Commission about the propane gas shortage and concerns over that here on Current State. As long as there is a shortage or disruptions in supply, Judy, what should propane customers expect?
We do advise customers to be very wise about their propane usage, reduce usage. We have tips on our michigan.gov/bewinterwise website that allows folks to look at different things they can do, many of which are cheap or even free to reduce their usage. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but it is wise to continue to be very aware of how much you have left to get through the winter heating season.
Now, the governor just declared another emergency, as you said, or extended the mm-hmm. emergency back on Friday. What are the other ramifications to that? I know you mentioned some of the measures he's pursuing with the other states. Are there other ramifications to that?
Well, the governor's doing what he can to make sure that the supply issue is addressed. One thing is the hours of service waiver for the truckers. Another thing he's asking is for the federal government to put weight restriction waivers in place so that a truck going to Texas from Michigan can come back fully loaded. And so that is something that's underway.
Okay.
Of course, we have a particular concern about low-income customers. Some of them, we have heard reports, are saying that they have a minimum purchase required. Perhaps they want to switch companies, and they have a tank from a different company, and traditionally a new company can't fill another company's tank.
Yes.
So that is being looked at, I believe, by the Propane Association, and customers should contact them to find out if there's something they can do to get a different tank and set up business with another dealer.
That all stems from Michigan's container safety law, which, as you explained, prohibits retailers from filling a competitor's tank. And this gets back to a conversation I had with Joe Ross over the weekend, again, Michigan Propane Gas Association, that when a company contracts with a user, it's assumed that company knows that system the best and that switching suppliers involves some degree of risk, hence the law.
Yes, so that's in place. I am told that a new company could drop off one of their tanks on a person's property, and so you would actually have two for a while anyway. So that is an option. We have had some reports where dealers are not taking new customers, though, that they have contracts in place to serve their existing customers, and they may opt, based on how much supply they have, to limit that to existing customers. So that is something else that customers may encounter.
Well, Joe Ross emphasized to me that that customers can contact the MPGA to verify some of these situations. If needed, I guess, Joe says the law does allow a company or a tank owner to provide written permission for another company to fill their tanks.
Yes, that's what I heard as well last week. So that is another option if they get that written permission.
Okay, that's worth keeping in mind. Does the commission have any better idea after the Friday meeting how long this shortage might last?
It will be something that we continue to meet on for the coming weeks, is my impression, certainly this week. And temperatures are still very cold, so we're using a lot more fuel this winter. Even natural gas customers are using 27% more just because of the cold temperatures.
Judy Palnow is a spokesperson for the Michigan Public Service Commission. We've been keeping an eye on Michigan's propane gas shortage and will continue to do so. Judy, thanks for the information.
You're welcome.
Current State on WKAR. You can connect with us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. We're always interested in what you think of the program and any ideas for segments that you might have. Our next guest has been studying or working on the Michigan State University campus for more than a half century. That's a lot of institutional memory. Ron Flynn is the former Vice President for Strategic Infrastructure Planning and Facilities here at MSU. Today, his role is that of a special advisor, and when he retires at the end of this year, after 57 years on campus, he'll have the longest tenure as both a student and an employee at the university. And Ron's here to tell us about his remarkable career at MSU. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you. Good morning.
More than 50 years working on the MSU campus, which is pretty remarkable. What visually, what do you remember when you think back to 1957 in this campus?
Well, one of the big things that struck me was when I saw the vet school that I'd arrived at the Cornell of Michigan. And I was born and raised 50 miles from Cornell in central New York. And that was significant because that is the campus that is very highly rated, and as Michigan State is. Also, the reception that I received here, because I was looking to transfer credits from a two-year degree to complete a four-year engineering degree.
So you were impressed at the fact that MSU had a veterinary school?
Very much. Okay. There's only 20 or 22 in the country. And, yeah, that in my eyes, made MSU a huge institution in quality.
So you were raised near Buffalo, New York?
Actually, I was raised near Syracuse.
Oh, okay.
And then I spent 3 years in Buffalo, so I've been moving west slowly, at least in the last few years, as you can see.
You began as a student. What was your first paid job with the university?
It was as a student employee in the engineering office of buildings and utilities.
Okay. And what did you do?
The first job I had was to do a little bit of installing a softener in the basement of what then was called the Woman's IM. It's now called the Circle IM.
Okay.
And I'd been working the year earlier for Union Carbide and had been their piping expert, which was the reason I got hired 2 days before classes started.
And you graduated from Michigan State with a degree in what?
Civil engineering.
Civil engineering. All these years since, you've been at the center of a lot of changes regarding infrastructure and facilities. What would you pick as the most dramatic change that you've seen? Well, and it's hard to boil a half century down.
Right, but it's, the most dramatic is the number of students. When I came here, there were 17,000 students, which I thought was huge because I grew up in an area where it was near Colgate University, which still has 3,000 students, and the other campuses were either 3,000 or 5,000. So 17,000 was huge, but we now have 50,000 students. Okay, this campus has just expanded dramatically. And just as a point of reference, the newest residence hall when I arrived was Shaw Hall. Wilson Road did not exist. So the cyclotron wasn't here. And so all those buildings along Wilson Road, when I arrived, the construction, Erickson Hall was just completed, and Student Services Building was under construction, as well as what we now call West IM.
Most of your years here, most of your tenure, you were directly involved with the expansion and development of South Campus here.
Exactly.
What are some of the broad strokes there in terms of the development of South Campus?
Well, we had to put in a new utility system. So I and another fellow was able to convince the campus we, in fact, could put in walk-through steam tunnels, which are very long-life facilities. Another colleague, Joe Cavanaugh, convinced the campus to put in 13,200-volt electrical distribution rather than staying with the old 4160 system. We had to build a new power plant, which has now got the name T.B. Simon on it. So this dramatic expansion of this campus and the infrastructure that was needed to build all the buildings that got built.
We're talking with Ron Flynn, who has been working on the MSU campus as a starting as a student in 1957, but he's been with the university working full-time ever since 1960. You mentioned the students a minute ago. Have you had enough contact with the students to comment about how they have changed?
Well, I don't think the students are much different than they were when I came. There were a lot of folks that were married, as I was. I got married less than 2 weeks before we arrived, so I guess you could say we honeymooned in East Lansing. So there was, and we had to move in back at Coral Gables at a trailer park because housing was so tight, and that was married students going to school. Spouses worked as my wife found a job. And so there was a difference there, but one of the things when people ask me, what's one of the best parts of your job? And I said, well, every summer, and it happened again this summer, past summer, walking down the hallway, fresh face, some student or a youngster got their student number so they could be employed by us. I say hello. They're so shy, sometimes they can't even grunt out a response. 4 or 5 years from now, they walk out of this place prepared to take on the world. That's what MSU does.
Mm. You've been at the heart of an awful lot of changes regarding sustainability on the MSU campus.
True.
Talk to us about that change.
Well, I was born and raised without electricity for the first 10 years, so I have a real keen feel
without
about that.
Without electricity.
Yeah. So I have a real keen feel about I still have a problem using drinking water to flush toilets, but we do that. Okay. I mean, there are a whole bunch of issues that if you have had to grow up under rather tough conditions, you get a feel for this. And fortunately, back now 15 years, maybe a little more, Fred Poston became the vice president of business and finance, had been dean of agriculture. And in conversations, Fred and I agreed that this campus should take on a leadership role. And as a result, we have the recycling facility with a surplus store, which is a way of getting rid of stuff on this campus. You either cycle it back into the campus, you sell it at the store. Mm-hmm. Worst case, you have to haul it to the landfill. The digester that was just built out in the dairy farm, we're now taking the food waste from the residence halls and feeding the digester, which creates methane, that creates electricity through an engine. And so that energy is being used out on the farms. We have our own water supply. Fortunately, this campus is blessed to have the setting on top of the Saginaw Aquifer and around one of the more highly productive spots. So we have our own water supply. And again, we encourage people to be conserving on the use of water. The electricity, same thing, okay? We have our own power plant, cogeneration. That in itself, we get more BTUs out of a chunk of energy because of this cogeneration concept. And everybody takes it for as being natural for the campus. But a few months ago, Board of Water and Light was given big points for putting in a, or the state of Michigan, putting in a cogen, be taking out an old boiler. Well, we've only had cogen on this campus big time for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. As an infrastructure facilities guy, Ron, did the disturbances and protests of the 60s and 70s impact your responsibilities much?
The biggest impact would be the repairs, like we wound up having to put metal window panes into Dem Hall because of the rioting that took place. We wind up repairing any damage, physical damage that took place.
Visually, one of my most vivid memories of the campus was in the People's Park days, especially over Acres Hall or thereabouts, and it was just nothing but acres of tents of kids and young people camped out protesting. Did that impact you much?
Not me. Back then, the grounds department was not
grounds,
part.
Yeah, a grounds issue.
Right,
yeah.
And grounds did not report to us until about 2005, I believe, when it got transferred, because the organization was buildings and utilities when I arrived, changed the physical plant, and still grounds was a separate reporting to campus park and planning until 2005 when Fred Poston transferred it.
When you compare the key people in the operation of the university, people like Fred Poston, when you compare the ones in the 60s with the current administrators, how had those folks changed? How were those people different?
Well, I worked for 9 of the 20 presidents. John Hanna, of course, with the ICON president, certainly a big role. I must tell you that our current president, Lou Anna Simon, is equal to John Hanna and actually has to work harder in fundraising than Hanna did because he went down and lectured the legislature on their responsibilities for higher education. Lou Anna is having to work much harder on private fundraising, intense, and she has a very intense assignment.
Critics have wanted MSU to lessen its reliance on coal faster than it has. What do you make of that discussion?
Well, if we can have a low-cost, abundant supply of natural gas, all of our boilers can burn natural gas. Okay, so we're capable of 100% natural gas, which cuts the carbon footprint in half. But gas lines can get interrupted. And so I reminded the campus that we have this coal pile, which is our backup fuel, if we can get natural gas at a very competitive price. It has been competitive. Right now, natural gas is rising, like you had just talked about propane a few minutes ago, and so fuel prices are up. What the critics need to – they don't have the responsibility to keep a campus heated or the lights on. And if you have that responsibility, you need to make sure – and you've got to do it at a reasonable cost. Otherwise, tuition is going to skyrocket. So the best posture to take is we have this flexibility in fueling. We use natural gas when it's very attractive price-wise. If it gets interrupted, we have the coal to use to keep the campus going.
57 years at Michigan State, no major career change for you. What made you stay here all those years?
Well, the other two job offers in 1960 weren't highly attractive. My wife didn't want to relocate. We'd made friends here. I was treated extremely well by the campus community, especially the grumpy old guys out in the shops, and it was just a fun place to be. So the deal was to agree to stay for a year or so, and as you can see, it's gotten to be a long
that
year.
That happens so often.
Well, you fall in love with this place.
I'll be here.
You fall in love with this place.
What are you going to miss about it?
Well, the people.
About your routine.
Well, the people. You know, it's as John Hanna said, it's the people who count. And that's what it is. It's the relationship with it, watching that new wave of students come in each year. And, you know, I'm only going to be 10 minutes away because we're not relocating. My wife says we're not moving. The sports programs here that we watch. So I can come and volunteer if I get bored. MSU has a lot of volunteer opportunities.
And, you intend to do that?
I may very well. It'd be interesting to see. There are some people who think I should go into consulting. I do not think I want to do the traveling that I think would be involved with that, but we'll see.
Well, it's been a long, impressive career with an awful lot of institutional memory. Ron Flynn is the Vice President for Strategic Infrastructure Planning and Facilities here at MSU. He retires at the end of this year after more than 57 years on the East Lansing campus. Ron, thanks for sharing some of your memories.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Starting next week, artwork from all over the state will be featured in the University of Michigan's Atonement exhibition. The artists participating in this exhibit are all connected by a shared aspect of their past. All the artists were at one time incarcerated. The exhibit is part of the Prison Creative Arts Project, or PCAP. The project, which is housed in the Residential College at the University of Michigan, provides opportunities for creative expression to incarcerated and formerly incarcerated adults and youth. Here to tell us more is the director of Prison Creative Arts Project, Ashley Lucas. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us on the show.
It's great to have you on board. Also joining us in Studio S, Eve Anklum, a formerly incarcerated artist who has participated in the program. Hi, Eve.
Hi.
Ashley, how did the Prison Creative Arts Project get launched?
Well, in 1990, our founder, Buzz Alexander, who is an English professor at the University of Michigan, was approached by a student who was looking to find faculty who were willing to teach in the prisons. Women in Michigan prisons had won a historic lawsuit granting them the right to get college credit while they were incarcerated, and they needed folks to go into the prisons. So Buzz agreed to teach a class in the prison, and he started off by doing theater. He had been doing guerrilla street theater with his students at the university, and he began a theater workshop with just two women in the Florence Crane facility, which is no longer open here in Michigan. And from there, he realized that this was really important work, that people in prison needed access to the arts, and he came to believe that the arts are a human right for all people, and he wanted to see more of that happening in the prisons. So he, instead of trying to teach more and more on his own, created a program where we train students to go into the prisons to facilitate arts workshops so that we can actually send upwards of 60 students into prisons every single semester to lead workshops in creative writing, theater, dance, music, and visual art.
And Eve, where did you connect with the PCAP program?
In 1995, a theater workshop was offered, as Ashley mentioned, at the Florence Crane facility. I was a kid, and I'd been involved with theater as a young, much younger, 10, 11 years old, and I'd always been a writer. So to me, it seemed very natural to sign up for this theater workshop, and that's where I met Buzz and a woman, a student from Chile, who came in, and we produced a play together, all of us.
And was it mostly drama that you were involved in, or did it become other kinds of art?
I took part in every workshop offered that I could get into. I did visual arts, poetry, creative writing.
The Florence Crane facility, where is that?
Florence Crane is in Coldwater, Michigan. Women were housed there for a very long time. And as the women were shuffled around the state, including me, PCAP was still involved and still coming in, so it was something that I clung to.
Where are all the prisoners or ex-prisoners that you serve? Are they scattered all over the state or where?
We work with every Michigan Department of Corrections facility in the state, so we don't go into federal prisons or county jails, but all of the state facilities in in Michigan get touched by our programming in some way. So all of the prisons that are within about a two-hour or an hour-and-a-half driving radius of Ann Arbor, we try to send in workshops once a week for different kinds of arts practice. And then the rest of the facilities in the state are still eligible to participate in our annual exhibition of art by Michigan prisoners and also in our annual literary review. So we publish a journal of creative writing once a year, and people from all over the state.
Why is this important, Ashley?
Well, honestly, I don't have the words to tell you how important it is, because there is so much going on with arts work in the prisons. Prison is a place that takes away people's humanity systematically. It strips people of their dignity, of their ability to tell the world who they are, even of their individuality. We force people to wear the same clothes and eat the same food and do the same things day after day after day. And the arts enable people to reconnect with the things that make them individuals who are capable of doing something good and beautiful. In prison, we focus so much on what people do wrong, and we continue to judge them for their worst days, their worst actions. And at PCAP, we really believe in the dignity of all human beings and that art can help us to get to that place.
Eve, how did this involvement change your prison experience?
In every way imaginable. Ashley mentioned beauty. Very little of that exists in the state prison system. Mm-hmm. So to be a part of that, to have within the facilities an identity as someone who is a writer or a painter, someone who is an actor, that is very important to me.
So that aspect of your life was clearly on the back burner, or did it exist at all, really, once you went to prison?
And before, it did not. I was lost. And so to be able to find myself again once in these workshops, and then today to continue to be in contact with PCAP and the Atonement Project has given me the confidence to go on and pursue my master's and hopefully a PhD at University of Michigan today. I don't believe that I would have had that encouragement and empowerment mm-hmm. without contact with everyone there.
How long were you incarcerated?
Altogether, 11 years.
Okay. Talk about this linkage program here for us, Ashley. This is what provides prisoners the chance to continue working on art beyond prison. Tell us about that.
Linkage is one of our coolest programs. It enables people who did work with us while they were incarcerated to continue to pursue a life in the arts after their incarceration. So we hold a series of events throughout the year, including a conference and an annual exhibition, which you all mentioned at the top of this segment. We will be holding that in the Residential College on the campus of the University of Michigan from February 14th on to March 14th. And that exhibition is all work created by people like Eve, who did arts work with PCAP while they were locked up and want to continue doing it when they come home. We also have a fellowship program for Linkage folks, a competitive fellowship that enables a Linkage member to be matched with a mentor, a community artist who works in the same genre, like painting or acting or writing, as the Linkage member and who lives relatively close to them, because, of course, people don't all get paroled to Ann Arbor where we are, so we find the mentors who live close enough to work with them for a full year.
Eve, I've got to ask you, how did your writing change? Assuming it changed at all, how did it change once you were out?
I think for me, the compassion grew for characters I create.
Okay.
It's helped me to be willing to go deeper and to be more thorough in my examination of whatever I'm doing, and to know that it's perfectly safe and okay, that art examines things that may not be beautiful, but making a piece of art from it is where the beauty lies, and pieces of writing or poems are pieces of art for me.
How are you involved? Are you involved in this upcoming event?
Well, I hope to attend. It's an amazing, amazing exhibit. I'm a national board member today, and so I try to take part in everything that I'm available to do. PCAP and the people involved have saved my life in a sense that kept me alive in my spirit. Mm. And so I would do anything to be around them physically, to be able to touch them and speak with them, and then also to hear literally the voices speaking off the walls at those art shows is just amazing.
The voices talking off
the walls. Yes, I can almost hear the voices of the artists. I've been reduced to tears more than once. It's such a moving exhibit, and I attend every chance I get.
Does it mean an awful lot? I assume it means a tremendous amount that your work is being seen by all kinds of other people. How critical is that?
Well, to have a piece of art chosen and to wait for that answer in prison, and then to hear one or two pieces of art have been chosen, my heart leapt, literally. And then to wait months and then finally hear a piece sold, or here is the feedback that people wrote to you in your piece, is something that I can't describe beyond words. Amazing and exciting and affirming.
Ashley, how many prisoners or former prisoners have you worked with now as a part of PCAP?
We honestly don't have a really good head count, because there are people like Eve who took many workshops during the time that they were incarcerated, and also many people who have gotten involved and gone away and come back in different forms, whether they join us with Linkage or they do some workshops in the prison and then come back to working with us after a time away. But there have to be thousands, literally. We have a network of PCAP alumni, meaning students who did the program with us and graduated and went on to other parts of the country. And just those who are active, those who continue to stay in touch with us, number more than 300 students now. So if the students who go in pairs and facilitate workshops with about 20 people in them number that high, then surely the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people whose lives we've touched number in the thousands.
Is there a particular artist, say, beside Eve, that stands out in your memory as somebody who really blossomed under this program?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that, because there's a man who I'm teaching with now at the University of Michigan named Shaka Sangor, who is a former prisoner who I met while he was doing PCAP workshops about 6 years ago. And he has been out of prison for about 3 years and got a wonderful fellowship from the MIT Media Lab to create work online that puts crime victims and people who have committed crimes in meaningful community dialogue. His name is Shaka Sangor, and we are currently co-teaching a new class called the Atonement Project, which has to do with this work he's doing for the MIT Fellowship. We want to use the arts to help people who've committed crimes and people whose lives have been shaped by crime think about how we might live differently and prevent these things from happening to other people in the future.
Eve, what are you working on right now?
I have a piece that I'm hoping to donate to the Atonement Project to be used in any way they see fit for PCAP, and then pursuing research in women and gender studies at University of Michigan, hoping to shed light on the situation for women in prison and to include, hopefully, that there are programs available like this. There are few and far between in the political climate today, and I wouldn't have been able to do it without PCAP.
We want to thank both of our guests. Our topic has been the Prison Creative Arts Project, or PCAP, housed in the Residential College at the University of Michigan. We want to thank Eve Anklum, a formerly incarcerated artist who is participating in the program, and the director of the program, Ashley Lucas. Ashley and Eve, thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A baby moose has moved into Lansing's Potter Park Zoo. Molly the moose was orphaned in Alaska when her mother died after being hit by a car. When that sort of thing happens, wildlife officials in Alaska arrange to send the orphaned animal to a zoo. Lansing has been hoping to get a baby moose for about a year, and when the call came in, the zoo was ready to act. Current state Scott Pohl talked with Dr. Tara Harrison, director of animal health at Potter Park Zoo. Harrison says in the wild, Willow would have died without her mother.
She would have died. She would have been eaten by wolves, or she would have been hit by a car, and or she would have had an even worse death, a starving to death. So there really isn't another option to just leave her in the wild and hope that she makes it. She was still young enough where she would have still been nursing and still needed care from mom, so she would not have been able to make it.
How big is Willow?
Willow is probably about 220 pounds now.
And how tall?
Actually, maybe about 4 feet tall. So she's fairly tall, but she's all legs and ears. So she's filling out. She's growing into it. And because of her being orphaned at that age, and they weren't able to bottle feed her because she was a little bit later in the season, so she may be a little smaller than what she should be, but she's certainly getting there. She's doing well.
How big do you expect her to get?
Alaskan moose are some of the bigger subspecies of moose, so they can actually get fairly large. So she'll probably be around the 1,000-pound range. A male bull moose would certainly be larger than that, whereas some of the moose that live like in Idaho, they may be, 700, 800 pounds. So she'll be bigger than that.
What might her lifespan be?
They can live up into their teens. So it just depends. Sometimes, though, the seven-year mark, they may have some issues depending, but they can certainly live well into their teens.
Tell me about being on an airplane with a moose in a crate.
I've never had to do that before. So I had, my doctor bag of all sorts of stuff that I could think of that we could potentially need. So I had to check that through with the security and all of that. She was secured in a crate on a rolling pad, and then with a net securing over that. So it was even hard to get at her. So if something were to go wrong, it would be a very complicated process, but still something that's certainly doable. So I had to plan for all sorts of different potential scenarios. Usually when animals are inside a crate, they calm down. And she was a little spunky, so she was kicking a little bit. But she certainly calmed down. And then when the lights go out, animals just really calm down. So in the cargo holder, it was dark. And so the lights were off, and so she was a lot calmer then. And we would go and check on her with flashlights and make sure that she was doing okay throughout the flight. It was a very valuable experience, and I'm very glad that nothing went wrong and she handled the trip beautifully.
Tell me about the surroundings where you are housing her right now.
She's currently housed over at our veterinary clinic. So she has a stall, and then she has three outside stalls that she can choose from. And we feed her weeping willow that we hang in specially designed, poles that we can hang the willow branches from. We've frozen enough to last all winter till the spring. And basically, she comes inside, goes outside. We're also working with doing some operant conditioning or training her so she gets used to shifting from one area to another. And also to train her for us giving her injections. We've trained her to draw blood so we don't have to anesthetize her for that. And then we've also trained her to stand on a scale. That's why I can tell you how much she weighs. So through all that process, we've been acclimating her to the way we do things and the way, that we can provide better care for her. And she actually does all of this for bananas. She really loves bananas. The exhibit's going to be where we call it sort of the duck pond area. So it's in the back of the zoo across from where the penguins are. And so it has a huge natural pond. So she'll get that whole pond to be able to cool herself down. And we're planting willow trees in that area too. So we're going to basically completely redo that area for her. So it's going to be a very naturalistic exhibit, and it's going to look very similar to what you would see in the wild.
How have moose from Alaska fared at zoos around the country?
They have fared pretty well. There's certainly other Alaskan orphan moose at other zoos. Mostly it's in the northern climate, so the furthest south is Columbus Zoo. I'm not saying it's not without challenge. It certainly is. Moose can be sensitive, and part of it's because of the temperature, and part of it's their diet. So They are very specialized in that they're called a browser species. So they eat the trees. So being able to replicate that naturally is challenging. And so having to do that certainly adds to the difficulty in caring for them. So that's why not many zoos exhibit moose, just because it's more work.
Living alone here makes me wonder if there will be a future for her in terms of socializing with other moose or mating. Is that in the works?
We are in the works of getting another one. We actually have a permit with Alaska to get a second orphan and get a boyfriend, basically. So we have that already filled out. We filled out our initial permit to get two moose. If two were available last year, we would have gotten two, but they weren't. So we're waiting for another year, which it's okay to wait this long. And then when she gets older, then we'll be able to have the male moose in with her when he's younger, so he wouldn't be alone as long. Hand-raising a female so it's calmer and easier to work with is one thing, but hand-raising a male can be significantly more dangerous, especially during rut. So having a male animal with a second animal the soon as you can is certainly a better scenario. So that's our plan, is that when we get the second one, yes, we may still have to hand-raise and, you know, do medical care when they're very young, but as soon as we can, put it in with a female. And then during rut, we may have to separate them anyways, because naturally they don't hang out together. They come together for breeding, then they separate. They may be exhibited by themselves for periods of time.
As a veterinarian, it must be exciting to take on a new challenge like this with an animal that's as big as she is or is likely to get, and an animal that you've not treated before to try to keep healthy. This must be an exciting challenge.
Yeah, it's certainly an exciting challenge, and it's also like a great way to collaborate with other veterinarians who have worked on them. And I did a lot of research prior to getting them and reading up on all the possible diseases, anything moose have died from, anything that they can get, just so I'm ready for it. And then once we've gotten her, you know, working with other zoos and collaborating, comparing weight gain and growth and things like that. So it certainly is a challenge, and it's something that I like to do, and that's the whole reason I work at a zoo, is the different species is certainly a challenge. And anytime you get to work with something new and learn more about it, it is very rewarding.
Dr. Tara Harrison is Potter Park Zoo's Director of Animal Health. Thank you, and good luck, long life for Willow.
Thank you so much. We really look forward to that with her. Yep.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we explore the Mobile Black History Museum. And thanks to an EPA grant, Lansing starting plans for a park on the state capitol complex. That and more tomorrow. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.